Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards?
Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we are joined by some people who make comedy to talk about something funny that they love. But this is a special Rule of Three because it's an open roundtable discussion about a subject that interests us. And the subject we're discussing today is stopping doing stand-up. And with us to discuss that are two people who have themselves stopped doing stand-up despite having done it in the past. Carrie Quinlan, who is a performer, writer, and ex-stand-up, and Mark Haynes, who is a performer, writer, and ex-stand-up.
Yeah, and the nicest bit to hear in there is ex-stand-up.
Really?
Hearing the words ex-stand-up, it's just relief.
It's like there's a proper weight off, isn't there?
Really is.
It's like,
really
I don't have to go anywhere tonight.
And is it like not having
I worry
homework?
About getting booed.
Yeah, and you know, struggle the whole day to get to that point at night. It's like being ex-schoolboy. It's a good thing to have gone. Yeah. It was fine while it lasted, but it's lovely that it stopped.
It's like ex-prisoner. Ex-kidnappee.
What is it? I don't know this because I'm not a performer and I absolutely would never do stand-up. Forget it. But forget the idea of you're playing 2,000 seaters or something like that. What is it typically like for a stand-up? What does a day go like or a week?
A week is probably a better call than a day. So it's probably once you're established. So once you're doing sets in clubs rather than starting out.
Yeah.
3, 4, 5 gigs a week of 20 minutes each. Each one of those involves about 72 hours of panic beforehand. So what, five? That's about 360 hours a week.
Do you set a watch
of
so you've
being
enough.
Worried?
Alarm goes off when you've had enough panic.
Yeah. And then you go on.
I'd have this, and I think this is also the reason why we're ex-stand-ups rather than current stand-ups, is I would properly not be able to eat lunch on the day I was doing stand-up because
really?
I'd feel so ill about what was coming up. I had a double problem with my act, which is firstly...
It wasn't any good.
It sometimes wasn't funny. And secondly, there was so much for me to learn, and I'd done it as a series of one-liners, feed lines, punch lines.
Okay.
Tim Vinyl or Stephen Wright.
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
I think the closest parallel would be at the time I was doing it with the sort of material I was doing. It was a bit like what Jimmy Carr then did well.
Yes.
But the problem for me is I'd linked it thematically. I'm a huge stand-up fan. Certainly was back then. I mean, it really was my life. And I didn't want to just do stuff that was disjointed. I wanted it to have a through line. And I think by the time I got to 20 minutes, I was nearing 400 jokes in my act. But the problem is each one
400 jokes in 20 minutes.
Yeah, you can see why it was.
I mean, I was nearing four.
The problem with that is it was all links of a chain, and if I forgot one, I couldn't remember the next one. It all had to follow on and flow.
Fuck.
So the fear of forgetting it, of being 140 jokes in and going, well, I have no way of accessing the next 260.
You can understand
why that was a thing that kept me awake at night. It happened once where I did forget, and it was because I'd got cocky, and I remember being about halfway through the act. It had gone okay, and I was about halfway through, and I remember thinking, now I'm going to have to get that train probably at 10:15. And I can get to that train, I can be back on the underground probably for... I remember thinking, are you still speaking? I had to stop and listen, and my mouth was still going, but I had to listen for the joke that I was about to finish. And that was a moment of absolutely white-hot, pure panic. What I wasn't is a comic who could just read a room. And the other problem with doing that, not being a comic who could read a room and adjust to it, was if it started to go badly, there was no way to stop it going bad.
Wow. So you're the equivalent, in musical terms, of an act who've got some backing tapes.
Mm.
And if you fluff a note to the backing tapes, the drum machine doesn't know you fluffed.
Yeah.
And so you find yourself lost up there, unlike a band responding to a room and playing a tune. And if they fluff it, you can giggle, look at the drummer, wink, and hit your beat again.
It was,
so you're up there doing a performance which is on rails.
Yeah, and it was
Top of the Pops.
Absolutely.
It was Martha's Harbour.
You are the All About Eve.
I didn't realise when I started it, but it was a dangerous way of doing it. And it actually became the thing that really made it impossible for me to carry on.
That does sound terrifying. My thing when I started out was I decided very loftily that I was never going to do the same material twice.
Oh, no.
That lasted three gigs.
Wow, let's shoot that down.
Let's burn that to the ground.
You made the elementary mistake there, which is something which I think is interesting to talk about with stand-up as a discipline, and one of the reasons I'm not a huge stand-up fan. Out of all the forms of comedy that I ever watch, it's probably one of my least favourite next to prank show. I really don't like stand-up as a thing. I like some stand-ups and I like some stand-up routines, but it's never been my favourite form of comedy compared to sitcom or sketch show or things. And one of the things I mistrust about it is I think it's dishonest, because weirdly, what you're talking about, Carrie, is getting up on stage and just being funny, never doing the same material twice. What I don't trust about stand-up is that tight 10 minutes where someone has learned to pass as the funniest person in the room, and they've learned it off by heart, and the room can react to them a bit, but there's that sort of fraudulence to it that I'm being a really prissy and prudish about it, but I find it going, I'd rather you were just funny. I'd rather you went for your ambition, which is to get up there and just be the funniest person in the room. And I don't really trust that one microphone. Someone's got the conch, like being trapped in a car with someone who's got something they gotta say.
Kind of. The bit I have a problem with the honesty is I was always honest. Or if I wasn't, I made it very clear that I'm being stupid and this is a joke. It really bugs me, and it really bugged me then, that people would tell these brilliant stories that hadn't happened.
Yeah, they made
and
up.
Actually, I think there's clearly a place for that in art, but it felt really dishonest.
There's a funny thing about one-liners as well, which is they are not pretending to be honest.
Yeah,
they are
absolutely.
Never honest, and you're absolutely right. What there was certainly, we watched some Bill Hicks.
Yes.
We watched the 1989 show, which is now called Sane Man.
We all agreed. We said we'll watch some stand-up to give a focus for the discussion. We said we'd watch a stand-up routine, which we all agreed was definitively influential, seminal, one we'd all really liked, and also someone we hadn't looked at for a while, to look at someone sort of at the top of their game.
I was in Nashville, Tennessee last week, and after the show I went to a Waffle House, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm eating and I'm reading a book. I don't know anybody. I'm alone. I'm eating and I'm reading a book. And this waitress comes over to me. What you reading for? Said, wow, I've never been asked that. Not what am I reading, but what am I reading for? Well, God damn it, you stumped me. I guess I read for a lot of reasons, but the main one is so I don't end up being a fucking waffle waitress.
At the beginning of Bill Hicks's career, he's about as good a technical stand-up guy with a microphone in a room. He's doing all the tricks, and you watch him and you go, the first 20 minutes of that Bill Hicks DVD will teach you all the tricks you need to be a stand-up.
And you're absolutely right about tricks, because what he was so good at was being in the moment. He was telling you, most of the material is almost like he's saying, this has happened to me, this is a conversation I had, I met this guy who...
Bosses. You know what I always used to get from my boss? Hicks, how come you're not working? I go, there's nothing to do. He'd go, well, you pretend like you're working, son. And I go, why don't you pretend I'm working?
And it's a brilliantly done thing that you only really notice after I watched that one from 1989. I watched some early stuff of his from 1985. And he's doing the same bits. There is absolutely word for word the same bits.
Mm. There's a bit at the end where someone shouts for a routine or a riff that he's done before about phoning someone in a small town and their phone number being 9. And someone shouts for it. And then they shout for it again later. And he says something which the audience just doesn't react to, which is, we were told we get 2 plays for a quarter. And he's saying, you're treating me like a jukebox.
Yeah, and even that was a piece of material that he used again and again and again. Stick a quarter up his arse and get him to do A12. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing.
The repetition of stand-up, I think, is one of the hardest things that a performer has to deal with, because it's very, very difficult. I mean, it's not so much nowadays. People do tend to do a show a year. So they'll take one up to Edinburgh. Mm. A lot of the time now, it will still be a work in progress.
Yeah.
And then they'll take it on the tour. And then after that, it's put to bed, and maybe it comes back 5 years hence. But that thing of, I started seeing stand-ups in about 1993, when I was about 17, and I watched them over the years, and often you'd see, even 3 years later, someone coming in and doing their 10 or doing their 20, and it hadn't changed. And it always felt like a dead thing to do. Funnily enough, around 98, Channel 5 had started, and they started showing lots of stand-up. And the reason they did that was because it was cheap to stage and cheap to put on, and it did quite well in the ratings. And what you had there was you had all the acts from the circuit doing their 10 or 20 minutes on TV, and that really sort of blew them away after that, because they couldn't keep on doing the same 10 or 20. You see the old alternative comics, and they were able to do the same thing again and again and again for years because they never had TV exposure,
but also because there was a slightly different setup to, or the stand-up that we did was part of second generation alternative comedy, I guess. Mm-hmm. Pre that, the whole club comic thing, doing the same gags was absolutely fine. It was playing your greatest hits. It was being a band.
I remember Will McLean, who we worked with a lot, he's a writer, said he used to be a pot boy in a working men's club up in the Wirral, up in Birkenhead, and he used to go and clear up the glasses from the drinkers. And he said he used to watch the comedians, the old school comedians, out the back before they went on, dividing up the material. You do that joke about Paddy on the building site. You do that joke about the mother-in-law. And they would divide the jokes up, and no one really owned their material. But the idea was this kept your act fresh without having to write anything new.
Do you think that's what Dennis Leary thought he was doing?
Can I ask you the first in a series of naive questions? Doing the same material every night, does it get boring?
The sheer fear stopped it being boring for me. I found it so frightening, but I didn't enjoy the repetition, and I very quickly began. It's a terrible thing. It's more about the fact that I didn't like what I was doing, but I didn't like audiences who began laughing at stuff that I was sick of.
Oh, that was huge. That was being massively disappointed in audiences for laughing at the stuff that you were kind of throwing away. And the stuff that you really worked on, getting nothing. And then the sort of the cheap stuff getting laughs. Hated them.
So irritating. The hostility of a room, I think, is another problem. I think that a lot of people, especially now that comedy, because stand-up is cheap to stage and there are loads of people out there, because television comedy started using a lot of stand-ups, I tended to feel, as someone who comes from a writing background rather than a performing background, that a lot of the comedy I was watching was people who were very honed at making an audience laugh but hadn't really thought very much. So basically you tend to go, by default, if you've done the circuit for a few years, your jokes and your sense of a good joke will be very, very sharp, but you will tend to go for a joke that will make everyone laugh rather than a joke that might be a better joke that makes half the audience laugh, because you don't want to die up there. And it's interesting to watch someone like Stuart Lee start playing with that idea and say, I'm going to divide the audience up until just one person's laughing, but they're my favourite person. Playing with that idea of stand-up, whereas the mainstream seems to be people who've gone for the biggest laugh for the most people. And of course, television executives will like that, because they'll go, that's a big audience laugh. But as far as the quality of the jokes go, you get, there's a lot of lazy references and button pushing.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing, I think, that I noticed when I was doing it, that there are writers and there are performers. That it's, that's, and stand-up obviously is both. But you can be a crappy writer and a brilliant performer more easily than you can be a crappy performer and a brilliant writer.
Absolutely. The audience in a comedy club as well, the natural way that they do it is if you're not a name and they haven't bought tickets to specifically see Peter Kay or Michael McIntyre, who are people they know they are going to laugh because they've seen before. They know they've been funny. When you come out onto a stage for the first time, when you're not a name, people are challenging. There's almost a sense of, how dare you come and stand here and try and make me laugh. Let's see what you've got. Sometimes you win them over and sometimes you
don't.
So
you think you're funny is the name of one of the big awards, isn't it? The idea being that that's the challenge of the audience to go, how dare you stand.
It's almost like their opening gambit is, come on then.
Yeah.
But Barry Cryer once said the worst thing he'd ever had shouted to him as a heckle was he was doing some after dinner speech or some sort of routine and some guy at the back shouted, earn your money.
The
thing about an audience, you see, is when you come out onto that stage, they have an inbuilt thing, which obviously goes back to when we were cavemen watching stand-up. And they can tell...
Barry Cryer.
Earn your rock. They can tell when someone is doubting themselves and they can tell when someone isn't 100% confident. If you come out with confidence... They go, right, well, that's I'm pleased because he feels he belongs here. She feels she belongs here. Now let's listen. If you come out and they go, they don't know what they're doing, they won't start listening. And they're so uneasy that they won't enjoy. And it could be the funniest thing in the world, but if you look anxious or nervous, an audience won't go with it.
Unless that's your thing. But even then, behind that, I don't know how people who do the nervy thing manage to get across that actually they're doing a nervy thing.
I remember watching Daniel Kitson for the first time, the first time he won the prize up at Edinburgh, whatever it was called, that particular year. And he won. And I watch him going, the brilliant thing about this is you are ostensibly a beta man. You're not an alpha man. You're not playing any of the alpha stand-up male tricks. You are saying, I actually would rather be staying in my bedroom with the curtains drawn. And I went, oh my God, but you have silenced this room by being an alpha beta man. And there's a performance going on there that you've learned a trick to say, I am a silenced voice that you're hearing for the first time, which is a dynamite piece of stand-up technique, but he's not honestly the person he's pretending to be, because otherwise you wouldn't listen.
Do you know what's... I did Daniel Kitson's very first gig, and it was in the Leeds... I think it was the Varieties, the theatre. And he'd come up, and he was wearing his thick specs, and he had headphones on, and he was playing Prodigy really, really loud. And I remember looking at him and thinking, this guy is going to have a nightmare. And he came out with the most sort of self-assured... A large part of the act was about refusing to step into the spotlight and refusing to adhere to the red light which came on when they wanted him to finish. And he just... It was a really odd thing to see someone whose first gig, they knew what they were doing. And I remember thinking then, I don't feel confident in a way that this man feels confident. I couldn't work out the difference. I really couldn't.
But you see that in the Bill Hicks thing. The thing that's amazing about that Bill Hicks thing is he's playing Texas. Well, he's playing a college town in Texas. But he's playing Texas. His routine, he comes out, he says, I am a UFO. I stop off in rural towns and play to bemused Hicks. And that's his persona. He is Bill who plays to Hicks. And he's immediately aggressive. And he says, I deserve to be here. And I am going to talk down to you, separate you out, say you haven't evolved thumbs. And it's a way of saying, look, I don't really share necessarily your politics or anything. And after a while watching it, you think, actually, the audience are on your side.
Mm.
You've attracted an audience who like Bill Hicksy kind of things by this point, but you're still playing the outsider who's come in, who's going to patronise and be rude to these people, because actually... That is now your persona, whether that's actually you or not, because that's the way you have, for the last 5 years, got over the initial hostility of a crowd, even though that's no longer applicable. And you watch Bill Hicks towards the end of his career, and he's still up there being like the lone preacher, even though he's playing to 4,000 people, all of whom agree with him. And I think that's another one of those insidious things that happens to the stand-up persona, is that sometimes it doesn't actually respond to the reality of the room, and you're pretending to be an outsider in a room full of people who absolutely love you, at which point you're going, this is just a performance.
What do you do? Sales representative. No idea what that is. I'm so... I'm an amusement engineer. Okay? Fuck this noise. What are these fucking careers? I'm a rep of the marketing demographics branch of the marketing of the rep. I foreclose on people, all right? Get out of my face.
Yeah, this isn't really you. And I saw Phil Jupitus recently do a lovely thing where he just relentlessly said from the stage, this isn't me. This isn't me. Even though he on stage is exactly like him, but he's not him. And you're being fooled that that's him because if you had a pint with him, he would be 5% different. And that 5% is himself.
Is everything.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But then that is why stand-up is an art and not just a thing.
Totally.
It's you do have to, as you can tell, words are my business. Stand-up is an art, not a thing.
But someone write that down.
But it is. I mean, there has to be a certain amount of this isn't the real you, because the real you wouldn't be on stage in front of a group of strangers trying to make them laugh. When they often don't want to laugh.
Because that's just a dick in a pub, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
If stand-up were a thing, if stand-up is a thing, it's the dick in the pub.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is why his
enemy is the heckler, who's another dick in a pub.
Well, there is. Yeah, you've probably seen the clip. I tried to find it on YouTube this morning, and sure enough, it's on a clip called Top 3 Angry Moments, Bill Hicks' Top 3 Angry Moments. And it's a very early, very crappy video recording of him in a club, and he throws someone out of the club.
Yeah, my mother. And you suck. You fucking cunt. Get the fuck out of here right now. Get out. Fuck you. Fuck you, you idiot. You're everything that America should be flushed down the toilet, you fucking turd. Fuck you. Get out. Get out, you fucking drunk bitch. Take her out. Take her fucking out! Take her to somewhere that's good! Go see fucking Madonna, you fucking idiot piece of shit!
I love stuff. There's that magic Larry David thing that doesn't even get anywhere near anger, where he drove to upstate New York to do a gig at some club, walked out on stage, surveyed the audience very carefully, said, "Never mind," and went home. And it's just so perfect.
All these things are confidence, isn't it? You're telling the audience, "I am in control." Because the last thing you can have is an audience that are in control. If an audience is in control, that is heckling, that's breaking. When I was doing it in 98, and when you were doing it sort of...
Same time. Yeah.
It was a time where there were two things, really. One is that we didn't have internet and we didn't have mobile phones. So it was harder to book gigs and it was harder to sort of get people in. Although... they were hugely popular, stand-up nights. And the second thing that changed was certainly, in my experience, was cocaine. And it was an industry that prided itself on excess, booze and drugs. And it made it a very sort of frightening, slightly sort of out of control place. But the one thing we also had then was heckling. And heckling was, if not encouraged, it was more than tolerated. It was allowed. So you had these quite sort of aggressive, masculine... nights where the audience would be a lot of it would just be, I remember seeing Dominic Holland of all people doing this at a comedy store, where the night would just be your 20 minutes would become 30 and all you would be doing is trying to get a handle on the audience so you could start your material. It would just be continuous barracking.
You're like supply teacher.
It was gladiatorial, wasn't it?
And people enjoyed that more than seeing an act. Someone then come out and say, "My girlfriend," and people would already be booing and there'd be more sort of coming in. And just watching a stand-up have to do lion taming became a thing that people really liked.
Yeah. But,
and if you were reasonable at it, you could turn a room around. There was a real magic with that. I mean, I'm not... I don't want to encourage heckling because eat shit. But... because, we craft things, you bastards. Or did. Not anymore, because of you. Anyway, it's fine. I'm over it. It's fine. But I remember I did... Mark and I did the new act competitions in 1998. There were three big new act competitions in Edinburgh at the festival, which were the Telegraph new act competition, with Telegraph open mic, wasn't it? You Think You're Funny, and the BBC New Comedy Award. And we didn't do the same ones, so we never met. So we've known each other for several years, and only in the last 6 months clocked that we were in the same batch of new acts, but just never, because I wouldn't do the Daily Telegraph because it was the Daily Telegraph.
Tell you how big those competitions were. I actually entered the So You Think You're Funny because it was advertised on the side of a bus in London, so some of the buses had So You Think You're Funny on it. That's how big those competitions were.
How did you do?
Well, I won the Daily Telegraph open mic. But
Carrie didn't want to win that one.
I didn't want to win that one because it's a Telegraph.
I didn't even get through to the first round of So You Think You're Funny. I did.
How far did you get?
I came second in both, in So You Think You're Funny and the BBC one.
So you both did really well. Packed it in.
Well, actually, what I was going to say about the heckling thing was the reason I got to the final. I'm absolutely convinced the reason I got to the final of the BBC one. I did a semi-final in Bristol. And at that time, being a woman in stand-up is still probably not the greatest bundle of laughs as an experience. But then you could feel a room as you walked on stage, go, oh,
oh, wouldn't really? You also, I mean, I've really? Very, very recently, I tried to book a stand-up night for charity and was told that we couldn't have more than one woman on the bill. And you think, well, that just increases the feeling that this is the woman.
Yeah. Rather than this act. Oh, it's a woman or a juggler. It was a woman a woman or a novelty act.
Oh, I'd have the juggler every time.
Oh, completely. I'm not a woman juggler. Jesus. But I did the semi-final of the BBC. I walked on stage and before I got to the microphone, someone went, get your tits out.
Oh my Lord.
I wasn't even there yet.
Oh my God.
But thankfully, it was an absolute gift.
Yeah.
Because I could turn around and say, yeah, standard heckle put down, boom. And the rest of the crowd went, she's all right.
You won the room. Completely. In one beat.
Yeah.
That's great.
Which was great. And but also...
Did you hire someone to shout that from that point on?
It was my mum.
Yeah.
It wasn't my mum. My mum was in the toilets being sick because she was so nervous.
Oh, my God.
What?
About watching me. But...
That's what being a woman in comedy is like.
Well, quite. Everyone just being in the toilets being sick. But that's the flip side of the low expectations of being a woman in stand-up. Was when you proved yourself, they sort of loved you more. That was really tiring.
Having to do that every time?
Pretty much, yeah.
And again, I suppose you're suffering from that billing thing, which is still the problem in panel games and stuff when they book female stand-ups, is you're asked to be the one woman on there. Mm. And therefore, it's very hard to be... Stand-up personas are really important. Who are you? As in, you come out, are you Eddie Izzard? Are you Sean Locke? Who are you?
Yeah.
And as a woman, you're often just a woman. I've been talking to Lucy Porter about this, and she said, I wanted to be, say, the flirty woman, and the other woman to be the brainy woman.
Right.
Like the men were allowed to have different characters as well as man.
Mm.
And it's the Smurfette problem, that Smurfette, her only quality is being a woman, whereas Hefty Smurf and Clever Smurf have other things. And you see that on panel games and on stand-up bills. The men can be a rainbow of different personalities, but the woman's stand-up personality, no matter which one she's worked out to come on stage with, is usually just woman.
Woman. Mm. Yeah, I remember being flyered for a Lucy Porter show in Edinburgh with the words, come see Lucy Porter, she's really pretty.
Oh, yeah. Did that work?
Not really.
I've got some flyers here from 1998 when it was
the dust off
the Carlsberg Ice Beer Comedy Network, which was Avalon's show that they sold to all the universities around Britain. And you as a stand-up would have to go. And there is only one woman in the whole of the bill, and that is Lucy Porter. She's supporting.
How many people are on the bill?
Well, this one, if you went to Surrey University in 1998, you could see Andrew Maxwell, supported by me, Ian Cognito, Rob Rouse, Brendan Burns, Lucy Porter, Dave Gorman, Robin Ince, and Mundo Jazz, and Alex Boardman and Ronnie Rigsby. So
she's there as a Tina Weymouth.
Absolutely.
I mean, Talking Heads lineup. The Carlsberg Ice Cream.
The sole woman on not just a bill, but a series of bills that took place over 3 months. I mean, it must have been, as a female stand up, it must have been. I found it a frightening thing of going to these places, these universities that were in the middle of nowhere. This predates Uber, it predates Premier Inns. You'd have to stay at hotels that were. You know, you get recommendations from the agency, but the hotels, I remember one being driven to one in, I think it was Birmingham or Loughborough. And I got into a cab from the university and I told the guy where I was going. And he said, why on earth are you going there? And I said, well, it's the hotel I'm staying at. He said, it's a bail hostel. And he drove us up outside and there was just, you could see through the window and there were just men punching each other. And he said, I tell you what, do you want to come and stay at ours? And I said, yes, that would be fantastic. Thank you very much. And I think about all the times that I was standing on empty train stations with no way of, you didn't have, if the local phone was smashed up, you had no way of calling home. You had no way of checking if there was a train coming. You had no train app. There was nothing. It really was. And I think as a woman, that must have been compounded to a series of, see, I don't know how anyone could have hacked it. I don't know.
I drove.
There you go. That was the answer.
See, easy.
Driving a car?
A woman.
I drove it backwards up the M4, but apart from that, it's fine. Absolutely fine.
My dad nearly got kicked off EasyJet for life once when he was getting off the plane and he saw that the pilot was a woman and said, yeah, not a bad landing for a woman. Oh. Can I ask you about your... You said your stuff was honest. Does that mean you didn't have a kind of stand-up persona, a clown?
I could never answer the question, what sort of stuff do you do?
Right.
I think I'm just not very good at... I'm not very self-aware. I think that is the main thing. So people would say, what kind of stuff you do? And it's like, I just sort of...
Would it be really... Would it be screamingly gauche to ask either of you if you can do any of your material?
If I can remember any of it. Oh, hello, someone's got a notebook.
Did you write it down?
From
Mark
the 80s.
Mark carries this book around with him all the time. Wow. This is the first time we've asked him to open the book he carries around all the time.
Once the book is open, it can never be shut.
Mark, I've never seen your handwriting before. It's fucking tiny, isn't it?
Oh, it has to be, yeah. I mean, you know...
Because all the 400 jokes in 20 minutes.
432 jokes on the back of your hand.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This was, I'd written my act in here. This is actually the one I did for The Telegraph. It is very 90s. It is very, very 90s, late 90s. And it has
their jokes about Hufty.
At the time, it was like, this is quite cutting edge. But the problem is, 20 years, it absolutely kicks a load of that edge to bluntness.
Or it makes it genuinely problematic and wrong.
Which is the thing people are finding with while you're watching Friends. There's a big chunk of that Bill Hicks thing. After he's done his tight 20 minutes, I remember even at the time, watching that, and I like that routine. After he's done his tight 20 minutes and he's earned the right for the audience just to listen to him, whatever he says, he basically locks you in the back of his car and plays The Doors at you and tells you The Doors are the best band ever. And if you don't like The Doors, he's going to rape some sense into you. And after a while you go, I'm bored of this and this is nasty.
Yeah.
But at the time, I bet that felt liberating and edgy, and the outpouring of his id and probably inspired generations of stand-ups to push something further.
Oh, absolutely. And you could see in our generation the guys who slightly picked up the wonky message from Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
Watching that back, I was familiar with it, but I'd forgotten actually how you wouldn't do it today.
How anti-faggot it is.
Yeah. If I don't like you, you've got no balls. Yeah. You must be a woman. What? What?
You might as well be female.
And you forget that he is actually, because he looks so ageless, he always looked about 47. Mm. And he's actually, when he's doing that, 27. Yeah. You know, he dies at 32.
He's still, I'd like to say, too old to be doing that.
I know, but it's a 27-year-old man
18,
talking about sex.
No.
That's the sort of... So I was 22 when I was doing this, and this is about nine jokes in. It's a section called therapy. I did a lot of therapist jokes. Worth pointing out, I'd only heard about therapy through the work of Woody Allen.
It's already problematic.
I've had a problem with my self-image for years. I had to see a child psychologist, but that was no good. He just played with Duplo for 20 minutes, drew me a picture of his house, and then his mum picked him up and took him home. Hey. After that, I went to see a sex therapist. She taught me to experiment with gender. I turned a female into a lump of gold. That actually sounds like quite a contemporary joke.
That's good.
I like to now think of myself as being very ahead of my time rather than not funny. this is a joke, actually, that I have seen. And when I did this joke, this was one that used to, when it worked, it would get applause. And it now seems like quite a hack piece of material. Funnily enough, to bring it back to Bill Hicks, when you watch Hicks, you forget how much of his material has become stuff that people who have never heard of him say. So yeah. Things like the warnings on smoking packets, yeah. Just get the one that says low birth weight, found my brand.
Yeah.
That is something that every boring person says. They tap on a thing and go, low birth weight, oh, that's going to be good for me. Just don't get the ones that say lung cancer. But there are about four or five things that he does that have just seeped into comedy.
Well, yeah, the one, this lovely one-liner about the guys wanting to introduce him to his wife and sister, and there's one yeah. woman there. Yeah. I mean, that's now absolutely. Part of the, that's common currency.
That, yes. In a writer's room, that's the first joke you do whenever you go to a rural community in a script.
Yeah, yeah. And this, yeah. This joke, when I came up with it, honestly, it was proper groundbreaking. Everyone was like, that is a brilliant joke. Since then, it's become common currency, and it makes me look like a prick. I went to see a sex therapist. I asked her if she realised the word therapist was a compound of the two words the and rapist. She didn't say anything to me, but she did note something down about it on my file. Now, that is technically, I mean, what was funny about this act is at the time it did seem quite dangerous because it had the word rapist in it. I met my girlfriend in rehab. I've got a Venetian girlfriend. She's blind. So that was her. I know. Imagine 430 of these. 430.
Did you get to a point in stand-up where you started to enjoy people going, oh, I, more than a laugh? Because I did.
I had a joke that was not good. It was not good. And I used to enjoy the fact that, A, people didn't really understand it, and B, if they did, they didn't like it. And I kept that joke in longer than anything else I did. And it was just, I wouldn't say I have the body of an Adonis, I've got the body of a Londis. It never got a laugh once. And that was the only joke I used to look forward to saying. There is a point, I think you may have felt the same. It didn't matter to me how an audience reacted. And that's a really good sign about when you shouldn't be doing this.
Absolutely.
It didn't matter if it went well or it went badly. I felt absolutely nothing. The only thing I felt was, can I get home?
Tick. My favourite bit of doing stand-up by the end was driving home on a Saturday night listening to Bob Harris on Radio 2. Oh.
Could you turn that into an act of just coming up on stage and listening to Bob Harris?
I reckon I could.
Can you remember?
Let's make that happen.
Can you remember any of your routines?
So my first ever gig was 2 days after John Denver died. And I loved John Denver. I thought he was a genius. Still do. And I was really genuinely upset that John Denver had died. And I thought, I want to work through this. How am I going to do this? And I thought, I've got that stand-up thing. If I do 5 minutes on how much I love John Denver, I'm 21. It's going to look ironic. That'll work. So I just talked about how much I love John Denver and threw in the odd joke, but not very much. And then opened with a really, really unpleasant, horrible joke that I'm not going to repeat.
Go on.
Here. It's really problematic.
Come on. I will cut it, Birdsong, and there'll be our reaction, our shot reaction, and the sound of you being thrown to the street.
Listen, we are talking about Bill Hicks
looking back on it 20 years on, I'm not proud of it. But at the time, I was really proud of it. It was around the time that TFI Friday was on.
Yes.
And they had, and the best thing on TFI Friday by far was fat lookalikes. It was this brilliant thing where a fat person would come on.
Oh, the 90s.
I know. It was a terrible thing, but it was genuinely, because a fat person would walk on and say, my name is so-and-so and I'm a fat Anthea Turner. And you at home would go, oh, yeah. you are. That's amazing. And it was brilliant and I really enjoyed it. So I walked on stage, first joke I ever said into a microphone on a stage as a stand-up was, my name's Caroline Quinlan and I'm a fat Karen Carpenter.
That is a good gag.
It's a good gag. But I'm not proud of it.
It's a sort of, I like the fact that your opening set, the first time you do stand-up, you say, what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up with a joke about a AOR sort of middle-of-the-road American performer, and then I'm going to do 5 minutes about John Denver.
And I've judged the room perfectly. Yeah, there we go. Here I am, it's South London.
This is bulletproof.
Come on, Bristol University, Freshers Week.
No, but I see this. I was watching the Bill Hicks material again and seeing in it a very strange reflection of something I find uncomfortable in stand-up, which is a power dynamic where the person on stage with the conch can get a reaction from certain bits of the audience that buoy them up and give them power that then means they abuse their position on stage. Mm. And all I can see in that Bill Hicks routine, and it's a dynamite routine with every single stand-up technique you could want in it, is after a while he is using his power on stage to just stay on stage and to say things he wants to say, and the audience are there enjoying the shape of it, but you're going, actually, after a while, you've stopped being quite as interesting as you were in your tight 20, and you are just going on and on about how if I don't like the Who, I'm a pussy or a faggot. Mm. And you're going, and what you're doing there as well is you are punching down, because you have the power on there and the audience have buoyed you up. Enough of the audience have laughed for you to go, I belong to be here. And the people who are uncomfortable have gone quiet. And after a while, he's saying about feminine pop and about homosexual pop that they don't deserve to exist. And you're going, right, this is the seeds of when stand-ups go wrong, because the unnatural power of that microphone, that PA and that room, and learning those skills of dominating a space mean you're dominating space like a bully.
I think it's worth saying, though, that his problem there is not with George Michael or Debbie Gibson. It's with the music, because he does, later on in his career, he does an entire routine about New Kids on the Block, and he levels exactly the same thing at them, because he just thinks the music sucks.
There's a bit where he... Well, I mean, I actually find the bits where he's talking about the bands he likes excruciating. And what it reminds me of is his debt that he owes to Sam Kinison, as a young man, I used to like Sam Kinison, and I listened to some recently, and it was just unfucking listenable.
It's difficult, awful, isn't it? It's really tough.
And it's the worst parts of Hicks remind me of the worst parts of Kinison. It's just Kinison was just doing nothing but that for an hour. You know, the power of coke and booze.
And a microphone.
I mean, what a toxic combination.
But also screaming about his ex-wife, which was genuine. That was all real. No, he was furious.
It was insane.
It.
The bits where Hicks, he's making that brilliant point about, you know, selling out, and about the difference between the music that he loves and the music we have now. That's the wider thing there, is he's talking about the changes of society, our willingness to be force-fed pap.
He takes a long time doing it, though.
He does. But also, there's bits where he sort of says that Rick Astley is an AIDS disease that's climbed off AIDS germ that's climbed off a slide. And it's just stuff like that really sort of, I don't know.
Oddly, it puts him, for me, that puts him back into, he's supposed to be against the mainstream of American culture. He's supposed to be this prophet. He's got, his persona is someone telling you the truth, a truth you've never heard before. Wake up, sheeple, is his kind of thing. And yet at that point, he sounds like Rod Little or Richard Littlejohn, who are saying something. They go, hey, I bet this hasn't occurred to you, some of those benefit scroungers aren't really looking for work. And you go, oh, but well, God, what you're saying is what mainstream America already says. That, I think, is dated very badly. And he's using the power of stand-up to dominate a room to actually say something that is not worth 20 minutes of my time.
But I think we knew that at the time. A lot of it.
Yes,
actually, because that was the thing that came up watching it again, was that there's so much of Hicks that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
But there's always a bit in the middle, whether it's Beelzebubo or Bozo or Goat Boy or whatever, that makes me go, oh God, really?
Him enjoying his personality as well. What I hate about that is he's up there, and this is, obviously, technically he's brilliant. This is it. Again, the technicality of the stand-up means you don't get to heckle or interrupt or say this isn't working, and he's doing it, and he's going, because the audience has gone quiet, he goes, oh good, I've shocked them, and he's doing this thing of going, this is who I am, I'm too edgy for you, I've got this persona that you can't handle. And you go, God, you sound about 13. It's very Adrian Mole. I'm an intellectual the world can't keep up with you. And it's just boring.
I agree with that, and I think it's you know, we obviously have to talk about him in context today. Had he lived, I mean, what you know, this is, you could go crazy about this. I imagine he would be.
He'd be coughing. 62.
He would, but I also think he'd be.
He'd
be following like David Icke, and he'd be, you know, he'd have gone sort of further down that route. I can't help but feel that. But do you?
I was thinking on the bus on the way in this morning, I was thinking he would be having so much fun with the current president of the United States, wouldn't he? He would be ripping it to pieces.
I could almost imagine he would be a right-wing commentator with Alex Jones.
There's lots of Alex Jones in it. There's lots of conspiracy theorists in it. There's lots of weirdly 4chan-y attitude. What's strange watching him now is he was obviously a very alternative, very against the mainstream figure, but that voice is now the voice of a lot of quite objectionable America.
It's worth pointing out that at the time, and you know, we talk about, you know, the stuff that we're not comfortable with, which I think, you know, there is a lot of that in there. But if you, this show that we watched was Sane Man from 1989, and it's really, really difficult to remember what the comedy landscape was like when he was doing that. And I mean, I had a quick look, and like the 1990 winner of the Perrier is Simon Fanshawe. You know, Dilly Keane from Fascinating Ida the next year is nominated for it. I mean, it's an entirely different world. And there
Cabaret
is this man who is creating
stuff.
And we watch it now, and it's easy to forget that there was nothing else like
but
that.
But I'd like to point out, I'm agreeing with Carrie here. I watched this at the time. I found Hicks very difficult at the time because I kept watching him going, you're technically amazing. You're one of the best stand-ups I've ever seen. But you are aggressively doing this, and you're in love with the idea of being a shock comedian. And I think Hicks falling in love with his stand-up persona is not a very pleasant thing to watch.
Well, I completely fell in love with Hicks. It's quite interesting in a world now where everything's binary and everything's I love this or I hate this.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah, watching Hicks again and having actually pretty similar reactions to first time round. Lots of it was breathtaking and oh my god, he's a prophet and I adore him. And then a chunk in the middle that made me think, I don't want to live in your world. This is horrid.
We should say actually that there are two edits of Sane Man. There's 1 hour cut, and then there is the one that we watched, which has got an extra half hour of stuff in there. So actually, the 1 hour cut is the leaner one to see. Mm. If you haven't seen this show, Pod Dogs,
it's brilliant.
Do because it's brilliant. Mm. The first. You said it's this tight 20 at the front of the show, isn't it? It's fucking great. There's so many things threaded together from the point at which he goes from
just the bouncing
buying the 32 ounce coffee and then being stopped for doing 300 miles an hour.
Yeah. What's the big one? And go, pull your car around back and fill her up. I'll get the pump going.
Go to some of these truck stops, middle of nowhere, meet some serious folk, man. Order coffee, the guy behind the counter goes, you want the 32 ounce or the large? How big is that large? You gonna want pull your car around back? I gonna start that pump. That sounds like a lot of fucking coffee, dude. I don't know if I want to be awake that long in Tennessee. You know,
his turn of phrase. There's a couple of bits that he uses which are just astonishing, where you just go, there is absolutely no way you could have phrased that particular punchline any better than it is just there.
That's road tested stuff. And I think again, with any stand-ups tight 20, you are dazzled in the audience at the way that a punchline lands because it's been tried 100,000 times before, and it's got that in common with magic, where a magician has practiced this trick so many times that they can throw it out and look effortless, and you can't believe how they did it. And the answer is, they've done it a million times. So you go, whoa, that's impossible. But actually, he's tried that and failed dozens of times. Like an acrobat, he's fallen over thousands of times. So you get to watch him land on his chin perfectly.
Mm. But don't forget, I mean, he was also doing material that was reactive to things like the Iraq War, which nobody else was doing at the time. I mean, there would have been people like Barry Crimmins who were doing...
Barry Cryer
you know, doing his political thing. Did you know Barry Cryer was... this is a story he told me. It's a proper Barry thing to go, I've got a story about Barry Cryer. Clang. On the day of the poll tax riots, he was doing Two Old Farts in the Night with Willie Rushton.
Oh, yeah.
And the two of them had been given a Bentley to take them to some kind of dinner they were going to. And the driver drove straight into Trafalgar Square, where a pitched battle was going on between all of these sort of like protesters and the mounted police. And Willie Rushton turned to Barry and just went, well, at least we're not in a Bentley.
But that Hicks turn of phrase thing, even in the bits that I find quite unpleasant, there's still time to go, oh, that's beautiful. I mean, the bit where Dick Clark as Satan is fucking John Davidson up the arse. The turn of phrase in there is, I should have written it down and I didn't, but there is time to stop and go, oh, that's lovely.
isn't it?
There's even a bit in that routine where, which is again really quotable, where he is deliberately going too far to try and lose the audience, and so he gets the chance to say to him,
"Y'all are staring at me like a dog that's just been shown a card trick."
He does that a lot as well, where he takes it too far. And actually, in terms of stand-up technique, when he's pushed the audience too far, he'll then push it a tiny bit further till he's lost everybody. And then he'll do a piece of written, structured, rhythmic prose that goes, oh, he hasn't lost it, and they're back in the palm of his hand again. Like you said, the only bit of my stand-up act I'm enjoying is when I lose the audience or when they're not interested. The next thing to say, I can turn this around, I can spin these plates, watch me juggle this. Bang! And you're back and you go, oh, he's still a professional.
Another of the tropes that Bill Hicks comes up with, I don't think anyone has done this before, is he does one of those pieces and there's the pause, the beat, and then the line, I'm also available for children's parties.
Yeah. Yes.
That's something, again, that you hear all the time.
I was struck by how much musicality there was in his routine, actually, I thought, because he uses his mouth to do things other than speak, doesn't he? You know,
he does cricket noises.
One of the things that people forget about Hicks, and it's because he's so good at the fiery incendiary stand-up, he's a really, really good inhabitor of character.
People say, well, it's a secondary smoke. It's the smoke that you smoke, but it's not the smoke that comes out. If it was just the smoke that you smoke, that'd be fine, but it's also, there's a secondary smoke, which also, there's been reports and there's studies that the secondary smoke is also...
The waffle waitress, the truck driver, you get within that stand-up, they pass so without comment, they're so sort of easily done that you forget that in the course of an hour, he does about 60 or 70 tiny little character vignettes that are just dotted throughout. It's
and then using the microphone to get different resonances in his voice and things to go up and down and to do things like the cricket chirrup and things like that, which is Norman Collier good.
He was one of the first people I ever saw who did use that sort of mic thing where he'd sort of make the sound of the gun and things like that. He was the first person who really that I'd seen who sort of went, let's think about the audio soundscape.
Apart from
this,
on Police Academy, obviously.
Where it was arguably done better.
One of my favourite bits in Sane Man, which reduced me to an absolute fucking heap when I first saw it, is the bit where he's doing Elvis. And when he's wiping his brow with a series of things, and he ends up wiping his brow with a stool before then carrying on being Elvis and dispensing Cadillacs to members of the audience.
I actually thought that was quite like my longest bit. When I watched it, I thought, well, someone's having fun. Not necessarily the audience.
But also, that's got that thing that has become quite a boring trope of do it until people are a bit sick of it, keep doing it until they like it again.
Because
in the middle of that, I sort of go, yep. Got it now. Move on. It's good again. Brilliant.
You can ride that five or six times if you want to.
But he ends up wiping his forehead with a stool. Oh, you know, it's so glorious.
Obviously, if we're talking about giving up stand-up, and Bill Hicks gave up stand-up against his will. But if we're talking about giving up stand-up, what is it that we're enjoying someone who's mastering the form and is showing all the tricks? That opening 20 minutes has got everything you need to learn about stand-up. Character pieces, observational riffs, exaggeration, callbacks, weaving three or four things in, flattering the audience, insulting the audience. Every single trick is in that opening 20 minutes. Once you watch that mastery and you're watching someone do this so well, and we're still saying we are so much in admiration of him, what makes you go, either I can't do this anymore, I don't want to aspire to that, or makes you go, this is a form that no longer interests me?
I can tell you what I think it is, and it's not why you change, it's something that you lack. So Hicks, for example...
Speak for yourself.
You were too good for the audience and have moved to another level.
Yeah.
Hicks is... He keeps going because the one thing he's got is phenomenal drive. He wants to do this, and he wants to be heard, and he wants to be famous. I've been reading Love All the People, which is a collection of mainly routines, but there's also lyrics in there, letters, diary entries, and interviews that he did. And the one thing he always goes across is that he's a huge star in England. He becomes a huge star. He's still a cult sensation in America,
like Jimi Hendrix.
And he wants to be big. He wants to be, like a lot of stand-ups, a rock star, with all the things that come with that. Fame, money, people listening to you, women, you know, it's all there. I think you have to have, if you're going to be a successful stand-up, you have to have a part of you that needs to do it. You want to be heard. You need for people to listen to what you're saying. And I think it's not so much a case of why you give up. It's that if you don't have that, it rapidly becomes a thing where there are other easier things to do.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, if you've ever been out with a stand-up, some people will say that that's a massive flaw. It just happens that in stand-up, that desire for people to listen, to appreciate, to applaud is something that you can't live without. It's why so few people do give up stand-up. I mean, it's a lot of people find it intoxicating. You have to be a certain type of person to do it in the first place. I think it's rarer to find people who do it in the first place and don't really mind, because the people who do it in the first place are the people who really need this.
Can you remember your last gig? And or can you remember the point at which you said, I'm not doing this anymore?
Well, mine sort of crept up. I think what's interesting, actually, listening to Mark talk about it, is I think we had really similar experiences. Mm. So we started out at the same time. We did the new act competitions, and it moved really fast.
Too fast.
And it certainly for me, it moved way. I was doing sort of semi-finals of new act competitions within my first 10 gigs. I was signed to an agent within my first 10 gigs. Mm-hmm. Wow. And then suddenly do a 20 minutes. You think,
exactly
ooh.
The same. Yeah.
And that's terrifying. And actually, I think was a big part of me giving it up.
Yeah.
Because it was just too quick, and I hadn't worked out what I wanted to do with it. But also, I like being in a gang is a big part of it for me.
Yeah.
The whole being on my own thing. That's intoxicating at first, because when it goes well, it's all you, and that's messianic and brilliant, and you're just surfing on these laughs, and it's an extraordinary feeling that doesn't last.
No.
And I found that the whole being on my own was starting to drive me a little bit insane.
The thing I'm most envious of is the period, probably in the mid-2000s and onwards, where young stand-ups began doing the same venue together, and they'd hang out and they'd, you know, work together, and they'd be on the same bills, and they had a network. And the one thing I didn't have was a network.
Mm.
I used to go to a university. I worked with Lee Mack, I worked with, and he was so lovely to me. I worked with other people who Ian Cognito was one. Good stand-up in his day, really good stand-up. He used to come out with a hammer, nail, and he'd smack a nail into the back of the stage before he started, and he'd turn to the mic.
He'd hang his coat up.
He'd hang his coat up, and he'd turn around and he'd say, two things you need to know about me. One, I genuinely don't give a fuck. Mm-hmm. And two, I've got a fucking big hammer. I liked Ian's act. He was a really good act, but I used to finish mine. I was supporting him. I used to finish mine. I'd go over to the bar at the end of my thing as you walked through in the interval, and he'd be sitting there, and he would say every single night, he'd go, that was shit. It didn't matter how it went. He'd just go, that was shit.
Did he mean it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It was hard to say whether it was tough love. He seemed genuinely to dislike me.
He was saying you were shit.
Yeah.
He was saying he was shit.
No, I mean, he was a good act. He was a really good act.
So he would put you down as part of his backstage routine.
It wasn't even a backstage routine. I think he genuinely thought I was shit, and he was trying to convey it to me.
I was going
to
ask about
by
this,
saying I was shit.
Something
there's a double meaning in that.
He might not have been wrong is the key. It's just that the problem is when you're at that level where you're going, I'm not finding this very easy, to have someone, you know, someone that I admired to just cut you dead every night. I started doing a thing where when I worked with him, he'd mentioned that he was trying to do something on TV. And I began going in each day when we were working together, and he'd say, what's going on? And I'd say, I've just got back from the BBC. And I could see him just sort of bristle a bit and go, what's going on there then? And I'd say, oh, they've offered me a sitcom. And he'd nervous like that.
Yeah.
And I'd say, it's called Mark. It's called Mark. It's about me. I'm not sure it's right for me at this time. And I'd try and make him have a heart attack. I wanted his head to explode. But it was a large part of it was that I think, you know, it's a much friendlier and kinder and supportive scene. Back then, it was like joining an oil rig and being 16 and everyone else was in their 30s.
That astonishes me. I really didn't think it was like that.
But at the same time, it's a career now in a way that back then, no one was leaving university thinking, I'm going to be a stand-up comic. You'd sort of trip over and fall into it slightly.
The hunger for it on television has obviously made it look more attractive. Obviously, in terms of spaces you can get to do comedy now, they are, as writers we know, getting smaller and smaller in the number of slots. But there appear to definitely be opportunities for stand-up. Live comedy is still doing really well. TV like stand-ups, they're cheap to put on. There's a regular showcases for them. But that feeling of being a bunch of solo acts, I mean, as someone, I'm in a writing partnership. I don't like working on my own that much. I like the collegiate way that you make TV and radio and books with editors and friends, and you'll work together. I found when I'm backstage at a show we're doing where there are a lot of stand-ups there, or my wife said the same thing, she was just happening backstage with some stand-ups, she went, that's a weird atmosphere, because everyone is, in inverted commas, supportive, but there's a real sense that no one's ever working together because you never share the stage together. But that feeling of a room full of stand-ups, as a non-stand-up, as someone who's never done it, I go, this is weird.
It's slightly different in Edinburgh, which is why Edinburgh was so magical.
Right.
Even if you did get on with people and made friends on the stand-up circuit, you never saw them. Because you might do a gig together once every 6 months, and that, you know, the 20 minutes before everyone goes on and then everyone goes home sort of thing. And that was your friendship. And suddenly in Edinburgh, everyone was around and you were surrounded by these people you'd sort of half met but thought were quite interesting. And then the collegiate thing sort of kind of came out.
I suppose you're all having a horrible time at once.
Pretty much. Yeah.
There is a sort of funny sense of a failure being infectious, which doesn't happen in writing groups. And there is something about stand-up, which is, you know, you don't want to be friends with someone who isn't getting this right, because it's almost like a superstition. I it's hard to explain, but there's something about being a stand-up in front of other stand-ups that is the gig that really scares you, because you don't want to look like a dick in front of your co-workers. The audiences, you never see them because of the way stages are, and you'll never see them again. But the other stand-ups, the last thing you want is to die in front of them. I do remember my last gig, just to get back to your thing. It was at UCL, and I'd had a car crash in Birmingham while I was going around the country, and I'd buggered up my neck quite badly. It was a real huge smash. I'd spent about 4 days with a neck brace on. I arrived at the gig, and the chap who was putting on the gig had seen the neck brace, and he said, oh, what's wrong? I said, oh, I had a car crash. Anyway, he introduced me. He did a long 15-minute thing of whipping everyone up. There was a Skol alcohol promotion on, probably 200, 250, and they were, I'd say, three-quarters of them were wearing plastic Viking helmets with horns on. And
it's a good sign.
This is
my crowd.
Whipping them up. People were just red-faced and mad. And anyway, he said, oh, well, let's get him on. Please welcome, direct from his hospital bed, it's Mark Haynes. Now, I'd taken off the fucking neck brace by this point, because I'm not going on stage with a fucking neck brace that's got nothing to do with my act. So people looked and they were waiting for a gag about me being in a hospital bed.
Oh, no.
I mean, it was just a bit of a nightmare. And I'd got to the point
where... Wrong persona.
I was standing up there, and I remember just looking out at this sea of Vikings. You know, I mean, it was, you know, hey, some comics die, I go to Valhalla. But I looked out at that, and I had a couple of friends there, and... I actually cannot remember how the gig went. And I'm not saying that out of any sense of, you know, oh, it went badly, but I've got to pretend it was good in some way. I don't imagine it went well. But I just remember thinking, I had a moment of real clarity halfway through. And I just thought, this is the last time I'm ever going to do this. And the second I thought that, I had another voice that said, remember how this feels right now if you ever think about doing this again. Yeah. And I had a real moment. I can almost like pinpoint the beads of sweat on people's faces, and I can see their open mouths and their sort of lower sets of teeth. It's the clearest vision I have of standing on that stage and just seeing all of these people and just thinking...
Lower sets of teeth, but not upper sets of teeth.
No. Yeah. And just thinking, this is just not for me. It's not for me. And I knew the act well enough at this point to begin thinking, shall I say something at the end? Shall I say... I mean, the people there...
I could be Ziggy Stardust.
The people there would have no fucking idea who I am.
Blackout. You know?
What if you got a huge round of applause for saying, I'm never doing this again?
Yeah.
Well, that's a great way to go out.
Free skull for everyone.
I got one laugh. Woo! But I ended up... It actually makes me cringe thinking of it. It's horrible. The Sex Pistols, when they finished... This is how much time you have when you're doing an act. The Sex Pistols, when they finished, they said, ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
Yeah.
And I ended mine by saying, I've been Mark Haynes. Ever get the feeling you've been treated? And it went to silence. And I felt, as I walked off, like I was walking on fucking air. And I put my neck brace back on, and I got the fuck out of there. And I've never done it since. That for me was probably the most important moment of my life, which was not starting stand up or doing it, it was stopping it. It was like taking out a spear in my chest.
the greatest final line I ever heard anyone do, and I can't for the life of me remember who it was. And it's probably an old line, but I loved it. It was one of those ones where sometimes you're rubbish, sometimes the audience is rubbish, sometimes there's no rhyme or reason to why it doesn't go well. But no one was doing well. This guy finished his set with, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, they say you're only as good as your audience, so tonight I've been a bunch of cunts." Which was so magnificent, but that was never
a joke.
It's great,
one
isn't
of the greats.
And I thought, I'd love to just have that, but that's not going to ever go with anything I ever do.
John Denver, bunch of cunts. You put it on your hand. You've got Denver cunts.
So that's how I feel about sunshine on my shoulders. Eat shit, motherfuckers. Oh, there was a lovely one though. I did a thing in Edinburgh in 1999. I did lots of 20-minute bits of shows. And that was one of those ones where I would get bored halfway through a set because I was doing it four times a day. And at some point in show three or four, my brain would go, "You've said that."
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And I think, but have I said it here? Mm. Oh, shit. I don't know. But I was doing a thing called Women in Comedy.
What was it about?
Again, the very idea.
It was subtitle, skirts. them.
Yeah.
And Lucy Porter was doing it because she's a woman and she's in comedy.
Often
and
the only woman in comedy.
Various other people. But Lucy was comparing, and it was mid-afternoon in the biggest space of the Gilded Balloon. Mm-hmm. And there was one audience that was so utterly silent that each of us, as we finished our sets, instead of saying, "Thank you very much, enjoy the rest of Edinburgh, you've been great, Ivan Carey Quinlan, good night," we just go, "Lucy, I finished." The most fun I had doing that gig the whole time was this deathly audience. "Lucy, I finished."
It is funny how, like, you know, the key to being a good stand-up is to make an audience do one thing. But there's also something magic about a stand-up who is trying to make everyone go as silent as possible. And when that's done, to leave.
Great. I've achieved everything I came here for.
Yeah.
Did Hicks always use that same sign-off in his routines? I think he did.
Pretty much, I think.
Which is beautiful.
It's also the most stoned thing anyone's ever
it
said.
It sort
on
of is, but people also talk about, you know, later Hicks became like irritatingly messianic.
Yes.
But early Hicks was
like
irritatingly messianic, wasn't it?
It's the one thing about Hicks, isn't it? He loved comedy and he loved being a stand-up. But I think, like, especially at the time, a lot of people went, "But there must be more to it than this."
Because you've mastered the audience.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, I suppose part of there's a good side to stand-up. Once you've learned the tricks and you are a master craftsman, you are like Paul Daniels, the Linking Ring trick. You're the best person at doing this. You can make an audience do anything. When you talk to stand-ups, they then get excited about what we do next. And a really good stand-up will get excited about, say, a reactive routine that involves the front row of the audience, like Dara O'Brien or Sarah Millican will do, when you go, suddenly it's an organic routine that evolves around your set material. But there's another thing you can do where I'm bored of doing that. Can't I be a rock star, a messiah? Can I have the answers to everything? Can I be a preacher? And that's, I think, where that sense of I was on stage with a conch and everyone was listening tips over into madness. Yeah.
But that's partly why I went into it.
Because you wanted to be in charge.
Yeah. Well, but I definitely went into stand-up in part because of Bill Hicks, because of that idea that you could make people laugh and make a point.
Intoxicating.
Mm. That was an extraordinary thing.
And I think I had a funny thing about the purity of stand-up. And then for me, doing these one-liners, which very quickly became a trap, I thought, what's the point? I've got nothing to say here. I was also 22. It was impossible to change my act because I didn't have any life experience.
Yeah,
And so I began thinking, I've got nothing to say. Why am I wasting everyone's time? That's a very Hicksian idea. There's no point doing it unless you've got something to give.
Everyone but a rare few stand-ups. Once you've done a lot of stand-up comedy, you know how it works. There's not actually, for most, much magic to it. It's, you know, it's some cogs and some wheels.
It's a mechanism.
And once you've cracked that, it becomes much less interesting. I found it much less interesting because I got to that point quite quickly again, and I didn't have any life experience. We're the same age. And so I had nothing sort of to do with it.
No.
And I didn't find it interesting enough. And there are a handful of comics I'd go and see now. Mm. Because I think who are doing, you know, Dan Kitson, people like that, who are brilliant and doing something slightly else with it.
I'm someone who doesn't know what those techniques are as a practitioner, but I think one of the reasons I got disillusioned with watching it is I could work it out as an audience member and a writer. I know where the rhythms are and where the beats are. And I stopped being interested in watching other people do it, even though I can't do it. I went, oh, it's a little bit like I can't play the piano, but I know what a 12-bar blues sounds like, and someone playing it is less impressive once you know it's only three chords. And I think that three-chord nature of bog-standard stand-up becomes very boring to watch. And then you get fascinated by people who either have taken it further and are doing, asking questions of the form, seeing what they can do with storytelling, stuff like that, or audience relationships, stuff like they're playing with the weight of their role and their authority. Or you start getting interested in people who've gone from stand-up into things like narrative or film, where genuinely the mechanisms there mystify you still.
If you're into dance, then you don't constantly go and see productions of Swan Lake. You go and see
the hokey cokey.
Yeah.
The mystery of the hokey cokey.
Any art that you're into, if it's done at the forefront and the vanguard and people are doing exciting work, it's always fun. A great way to really fall out of love with stand-up is to do it. I couldn't watch it for years afterwards.
Really?
And yeah. Even now, if people say, do you want to go and see some stand-up, it's absolutely dependent on who's on. I wouldn't go to a comedy club anymore.
When stand-up is good, there is nothing else like it, because it feels, whether it is or not, it feels like a unique and once-in-a-lifetime show. Mm. That's the beauty of stand-up. You know, if you go and see it the next night, it's going to be slightly different.
But again, that's Edinburgh, I think. I think when people have crafted their hour rather than trotted out their 20 minutes, it's an entirely different beast, and that's when it becomes an art form.
Yeah.
I went from stand-up into acting. When I gave up, I went to drama school and had, again, that same experience of I'm in a group, everyone's pretty supportive. This is brilliant. This is what I was after. And in fact, it was what I was after before. I was applying for drama school when I was doing the new act competitions, and I got absolutely nowhere because I was dreadful. And then sort of learnt through stand-up some helpful things and some massively unhelpful things for acting.
Oh, really? What's unhelpful that you learn for acting?
The biggest thing I learned from stand-up that I could sort of see a connection with the acting thing that was an unhelpful thing, which was, in stand-up, you've got barriers up all the time. You're always on the lookout for a heckle. Just think it could come any minute, and this could be the show that where I die. This could,
you're under attack. So you're defensive.
Absolutely. And in acting, that's absolutely hopeless. The vulnerability is massively important. I'm far more open playing Shakespeare than I ever was as me on stage as a stand-up. Far more. Which was really odd to work out, and took 3 years of drama school, and probably more than that. It was great. My first year of drama school, the head of movement, who was a brilliant woman called Wendy Allnut, basically wanted to beat the stand-up out of me.
I've seen a lot of stand-ups. I'd like to see that.
But very gently, but very firmly, wanted to get rid of all this comedy shit and, you know, actually, where are you sort of thing. Having, you know, now as an actor and having learnt about acting and learnt more about that, that's more magical in a way that learning about stand-up made it far less magical. It was really interesting. When I see a good acting performance now, it blows me away more than it did before.
There's more to reveal in it. I think maybe that's the thing with stand-up, is that it's like if you know how sausages are made, sausages are less appetising.
Yeah. Mm. There's a funny thing, which is, as a stand-up, you're also aware that nothing that you say is ever going to be one iota as funny as the fun that you have with your friends in a pub. And so it's a funny thing where you're chasing for laughs that are never going to be as good as the good time you could be having if you weren't sitting watching a stand-up doing, but you were in a pub having a drink.
Are you saying the thing that I suspect is true of stand-up is it is to being funny in a pub what porn is to actual sex? Mm. It is acting as if you're the funniest person in the pub, but actually you're just acting.
Yeah. People go out and do stand-up shows when that's the last thing they want to do. They're having a terrible day. It's awful. They've got a family member ill, and they have to go out there and get them yuck chucks
I cannot imagine that. I cannot imagine going out there and making people laugh and being your stand-up persona when you're having a shit day. It must be one of the most confusing and soul-destroying
experiences. But it is and it isn't, because it's not really about having a good time or being funny. It's about saying the lines that you know to get a reaction, which you may not even hear.
Right.
It's an art. It's what you do. Talking of just, it can't be a good time all the time. I brought this with me, which is, it's Bill Hicks's obituary from The Guardian. And this was 6th of March 1994. And the reason I kept it is this is the way that I found out Bill Hicks had died. So I was a huge fan of his. And predating social media, he wasn't a big enough name to make it onto television, onto the news. This was the first time that... So he died in February, and then about a week later, there was a Guardian obit. So I opened it up, and Bill Hicks, the funny man, was dead. But what this obituary really does is it really sets up what he would become in death, which is they really sort of talk about he was one of the most daring American stand-up comedians of his generation. They really sort of set out. And what was interesting about Hicks is people knew how good he was at the time. And his death really just it nailed it. It really nailed it because it locked him in Aspic.
Yeah. You know?
And it's there's a line in here where Hicks had written a letter to John Lahr, who was the journalist who wrote some brilliant books, a great one on Barry Humphreys, which is really worth reading. Well. He said that Hicks had written him a letter quoting Noam Chomsky. And the young me has highlighted this. The responsibility of the intellectual is to tell the truth and expose lies. And that was, I think, it's a very good summation of what he was doing. He was trying to tell the truth as he saw it. And actually, has there been another comic that really does that?
That's a very good question.
He's in the tradition, and they're placing him in a tradition there in American comedy with Lenny Bruce, and probably the person no one ever mentioned, which is George Carlin, who I think is probably the only person I've ever seen who comes close as a sort of countercultural figure who was just a truth teller, but is an astonishing stand-up. But I think there's rhythms in common between George Carlin's weariness at humanity's disappointing nature and Hicks's pure misanthropy. That what you're saying when there's an obituary for him and he's not a major figure enough to be on the news is to say this guy was in that tradition of whom there are very few.
Yeah, and he did talk about his comparisons with him and Lenny Bruce. Hicks, and he said we are similar insofar as when we're on stage we're being ourselves, and that's the important thing. This obituary has the best single line that you could ever hope for in an obituary. He spoke his maverick heart, and he was very, very funny.
That really brilliant.
Is just that'll do.
That's
thrilling.
Is perfect. That's where we end this. Mark Haynes, Carrie Quinlan, thank you very much for coming on Rule 3.
Thank you. You have a time talking your way out of that ticket. You know how fast you were going, son? 70. You're going 300 miles an hour, buddy. What the hell are you doing? Sorry, sir, I had this large coffee back at that truck stop. I'm fucking flying. Huge coffee. I bought some dirt. I thought that'd slow me down, but no. Biggest motherfucking coffee I ever seen. He pumped it right up my nose. Just skin covering coffee right now.
The BBC New Comedy Awards are an annual event designed to find the best new stand-up in the UK, and pretty much what happens is they're organised by Radio 4 and sponsored by BBC Talent 2000. The rules are that all our contestants tonight haven't done a paid gig at the time they enter the competition, so when they enter the competition they're all amateurs.
Caroline Quinlan, first lady on.
She's really, really good, isn't she? Very confident.
I could feel myself shaking throughout.
And blowing our monikers is an obvious game, but first time I've heard it, I thought that was that made me laugh.
Yeah, it felt okay. It felt like people were laughing.